Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The Vietnam War draft dodger insists on the military parade on his birthday, which is also the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary, as if he were some petty dictator. Today is June 5th, the date Robert Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated just after winning the California primary in his quest for the presidency in 1968, 5 years after his brother John, who was president, was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, my mother's birthplace. Yesterday, on June 4th, 1892, the Sierra Club was founded to, quote, make the mountains glad, unquote, in the words of the great environmentalist and first Sierra Club president, John Muir, who served in that position until his death in 1914, the year World War I started. Yesterday was also the date in 1919, a year after the First World War ended, that the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution granted American women the right to vote. As Martha Washington might have exclaimed, it was about time. And now, in response to a U.S. Army military parade in commemoration of its 250th, which Donald Trump claims is also the militant celebration of his natal day, I read something I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, which I call Flowers for All. At the end of May, the United States gets sentimental about its citizens who died in its wars. Graves of American war dead, who are buried all over the world, are smeared with flowers and tears. Hundreds of thousands more remain unfound and unburied and have provided nutrients for war-blasted soil or meals for undersea life. The dead are not remembered as the terrible cost of the wars that killed them. They are used instead to recruit fresher crops for planting underground. Memorial Day has, from its beginning, just after the Civil War, been a rallying cry for war, however unusual it might seem for the specter of death to be a successful recruiter. The war dead are praised by the country's leaders, who extol their lifeless co-conspirators to sound the war cry for more wars and suggest to newer generations that only such acts of sacrifice justify the lives of able citizenry. Families and friends lay flowers on the graves, and though they grieve, they seldom question the rightness of the loss. Each modest gesture toward peace is buried underneath official contempt and scorned by a war mentality that, like weapons technology, is vividly self-perpetuating. Harsh religious and military values are imposed on our society, which seems indifferent to its ideals of freedom and equality. The war and the worship of wealth and power are substituted for human rights. Our most cherished values serve as war cries to commit horror, and we choose leaders who offer us nightmares disguised as dream worlds. The only purpose for the existence of armies, despite claims of righteousness and deceptions of pageantry, is the destruction of other human beings. Soldiering is big business, the first order of every empire, as it has always been for generations of war men sent out to kill and die by every culture and society. But soldiers themselves are little more than expendable pawns, readily discarded. Paeans of glory, duty, and patriotism are perhaps a greater treachery than the hoax of original sin. Arguments for war are as stale as the bones beneath the flowers. The world has changed. Humanity has seen it from space, small and frail. The same technical mastery that sends rockets to the stars is also capable of sending them on a much shorter, final journey of obliteration. The most fundamental struggle in history is between advocates of world suicide and those who oppose it, which is the real war of our era. If we do not reverse direction, we will all probably be among the war dead, and there will be no one to provide us graves or bring us flowers. And that was something I wrote for my newspaper, the now defunct North Coast Times Eagle, which perhaps I read as a memorial to it as well as to the dead of war. The story of war is one of kidnapping, slavery, and rape, and what we talk about is strategy and territory. And this was written by Zoe Williams for The Guardian. I would not ordinarily rush to the Imperial War Museum in London because the place is one tricky proposition. I spent hours there when I was young researching black servicemen in the First and Second World Wars as part of a bigger project about multicultural London. Newsflash, it's been multicultural since forever. The archives are incredible, and the staff could not have been more helpful. Yet every day, ambling past the giant death machines at the doors of the museum, past the flying injury bringers that hang from the ceilings, I could not help but think, pick a lane. Guys, either war is a bad thing, featuring real humans who lose their comrades, get hurt, and killed, or if not, are changed forever in the service of an idea that later turns out to be some imperialist BS. Or war is a good thing, because look at all this mighty equipment. It can't be both. Maybe the ambivalence wasn't the museum's. Maybe it was my own, because I continued to go there until I took the kids when they were about 7 and 9, and found myself having to explain the significance of Colin Self's Beach Girl, 1966, in which the artist used a mannequin, blackened and mutilated, to convey the likely physiological impact of a nuclear attack. They both started crying, which maybe I should have predicted. Anyway, they are older now, but not old enough for its current exhibition, Unsilenced Sexual Violence in Conflict, which none of us are. You may have the broad outlines of disparate atrocities in your head, the sex slaves taken by the Japanese Imperial Army between 1932 and 1945 as comfort girls, the rape of German women during the Soviet liberation, and the kidnapping and rape of Yazidi women in northern Iraq just over a decade ago. You may even know, though I did not, about the rape of Ukrainian men by soldiers of the Russian Federation in this current war. In your lifetime, you will have lost count of how often you have passed war memorials to unknown soldiers, to RAF bombers, to animals, but you probably won't have seen sexual violence set in stone, which absence gestures towards one recurring theme in the code of silence. No society wants to look directly at this crime because its details are hideous. I don't ever want to think again about the use of the bayonet in Boer War sex crimes. Code of silence sounds simple, but would run to 1,000 subclauses. There is social squeamishness, survivor's shame, an understandable sensitivity about the children who are born of rape. It is well known that if you make your testimony and are not believed, the brutality is revivified. The jeopardy of saneness allowed to a post-war society that did not want to hear it, it would have been immense. At the end of the account of one victim, a Welsh woman married to a Belgian man, she had been raped by German soldiers while heavily pregnant and lost her baby shortly afterwards. There is a note from the recording official, quote, a decent little woman and quite reliable, no exaggeration attempted, unquote. There is something so revolting about the thought that your own decency would have to be adjudicated before you could be heard. That exaggeration would be assumed unless some random guy deemed it absent, and that you probably only made the cut because you happened to be Welsh, not Belgian. Threading through the exhibition are academic voices describing the complex interplay between militarism, humiliation, barbarism, and the patriarchy, but just to be really ham-fisted and painfully straightforward about all this. War is the precondition, the portal from civilization into cruelty. This morning started with a thrum of news from the Ukraine-Russia peace talks to the defense spending review, and it feels as though none of these conversations should be allowed to happen without first taking a minute to observe that war turns some soldiers, enough soldiers, into something less than human, and the results of that stain history forever. It feels like the casual dehumanization of military aggression gets lost in the margins of territory, strategy, and percentages. And that was by Zoe Williams, who wrote this for The Guardian. And now, it's silly season time. Time to hit the road. And so now I read a poem by Juanita Huebner, The Great American Car. We wear our cars, glass, plastic, steel clothing, clothed in boxes, heavy as houses, plated and armored, licensed to drive our desires, cinema verite on rubber tires, tirelessly headed for anywhere, for nowhere, auto-motivated. We wear our cars, skins shine, straight jackets lined, nights spun on dark rivers of tar. Car, war, war for blood, war for business, war to keep us moving, moving to gas stations, moving 9 to 5, moving to sheer madness. Accelerator, keep cool when your hood flips up and the jack-in-the-box pops up, asking you for proof of insurance. Keep cool and use your horn to warn other drivers. When you're completely out of control, slow down before entering metaphysical, transmeditational, sexual curves, but never forget to wear your car daily like a vitamin, daily like a prayer, like a universal differential manifold shock absorber, because the world's a scary place we cruise through, we loose through on the highways, byways, skyways, your way, my way, wearing our cars, wearing our General Motors Mason jars, our Chevy Chevrolets, our macho machines, our dual injection erection machines with gabardine pants, a cold watch, and a cigar in your mouth with pantyhose, lipstick, and a perm, with all the cosmetic wonders in a stop-go maze, in a fast, slow craze of constant red rosary bead taillights, votive candles of empty nights, with the windows rolled down and the wind whipping in, pulling in, streaming out, the cheeseburger wrappers and beer cans, pulling out the condoms, the radio kingdom of Billy Graham, pulling out roadmaps and wedding rings, pulling out St. Christopher and all kinds of things, pulling out the half-thought thoughts, the twice-feared fears, the profiles of tears, the cigarette silence for years of miles along the road made of cars, tattooed in rust, tattooing the earth with long indelible scars, lined with weeds and dust. We wear our cars, our polished cases of velocity, strapped to mechanical necessity, and all is visible and elusive, also near, yet can't be touched. Hypnotized deep by the yellow ribbon, hypnotized deep in the middle of an eye, into a blank stare, staring back, wearing black, our cars, glistening, listening, in a closet of vanishing echoes, through streets of instantaneous architecture, of instantaneous cars. Cars, junkyard carcasses, carpal tunnel syndrome on the steering wheel, Carmen Miranda on a dashboard veranda, carnal desire for a Jaguar, car hop, fill her up with a root beer float, carnivorous soul, freeway to everything, cartoon axle pointed straight at the moon. Carlos, muchacho, you look fine in that Gran Torino El Camino, carbon cop, 4x4s multiplying to infinity, aerial view of used Carriots on TV, cardinal virtues, gears, brakes, pistons, points of a motorized destiny, bumper to bumper, like words of an endless sentence, sentenced to speed, talking at 80 miles an hour and over the limit, wearing our cars, our sacred cars, our holy cars, in cars we trust, cars. Hallelujah. Amen. And that was by Juanita Huebner, Great American Car. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. If any American should be tried for treason, it is Donald Trump, whose initial attempt to overthrow the American democracy was based on his character, reflexive compulsion of serial dishonesty and bald-faced lying, plus a nakedly despotic intent to undermine the election he lost by a majority vote of American citizens, which ultimately convicted him as a felon for blatantly disavowing the peaceful exchange of power that distinguishes democracy from aristocracy, and will again most likely attempt to choke the throat of democracy like every other sort of bloviated tyrant. Trump was a lousy frump as president his first term and has already shown himself to be even more grotesquely despotic, literally parading his totalitarian insanity down Main Street USA as a birthday gift to himself in tandem with the U.S. Army, which he draft dodged in a time of war.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.